This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Corporate giants walk the earth, soulless and immortal. Exxon, Microsoft, McDonald's. These companies and others are inextricably intertwined in our lives. We buy from them, work for them, invest in them. The company is such a pervasive economic and cultural institution, it's hard to imagine a time before it existed and what the world might be like without it. For some, that might be a rough outline of utopia. From the beginning, critics say, companies have been the rapacious edge of capitalism, mechanisms of greed, corruption, and shattered hopes. John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge have a very different point of view. In their new book, The Company, A Short History of a Revolutionary Idea, they argue that the modern company is the engine of liberty and prosperity and the secret weapon that drove a benighted West past once more advanced societies in China and the Islamic world. Not that it's been perfect. Far from it. Micklethwaite and Wooldridge trace the evolution of the company from the earliest records of commerce in Mesopotamia through Greece and Rome, the rise of mercantile empires in Europe, to the great East India Company that had an empire and an army all its own, to the dawn of the modern corporation in Victorian England and the cycle of boom and bust of expansion and reform that have followed ever since. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Adrian Wooldridge. At the BBC's broadcasting house in London is John Micklethwaite. They are the co-authors of The Company. They also both work for The Economist magazine, and welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What role have companies played in your life? Are you a company man or woman, or have you tried to avoid them, or at least avoid working for them? After Enron et al., has your opinion about corporations, their role in the world, and their role in your life changed? Give us a call. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And John Micklethwaite, let's begin with you. Define for us what is a company as you describe it in the book?
I think there are two sorts of companies. You can narrow it down to just being a limited liability joint stock company, which pretty much took off in the 1850s around then, and that's what built the modern world. Or else, quite a lot when you talk about companies in general, people talk about them in terms of businesses. And those more general sorts you can trace back, as you said, all the way back to Assyria, and you find odd partnership details back from then. But the basic idea, I think, of the modern company, of the one that we recognize, is really sort of set free in the 1850s by, of all people, the Victorians. It's one of those quaint, strange British inventions that helped change the world.
Well, for the sake of brevity, let's skip past 5,000 years of recorded history. And Adrian Wooldridge, this Victorian invention, the company, a lot of people would say what happened in the 1850s was really the Industrial Revolution.
Well, I think what the company did in the 1850s and 60s was to bring together a number of ideas. The idea that you could invest money in a company and only be liable for the amount of money you'd invested, the idea of buying and selling shares, but also the idea that companies are independent institutions, that they don't have to do the government's work. Up until then, in order to get a charter as a corporation, you had to go specifically to the government and promise to do certain good works. In the 1850s and 60s, it was made an automatic thing, and I think this very rapidly created extraordinarily powerful wealth-producing organizations which spread all around the world, all around the United States, all around Europe, and very, very rapidly, if the Industrial Revolution was already taking place, they enormously spurred the speed of progress there.
John Micklethwaite, if you did not have one of these government charters, your only other option was a partnership which involved everybody taking all the risk.
Well, you go back, there's a very good literary example of that. If you look at Dickens' book, Dombey and Son, you have a classic example of somebody who thinks he's all right in a family partnership, but in fact he trusts somebody to run it. Suddenly he has unlimited liability and the whole thing collapses. Naturally, companies, limited companies, have had what might be described as a number of problems since then, but they have at least got rid of that problem. You only lose what you put into it. That may be little compensation to the people who put their money into companies like Enron, but it's a completely different thing to suddenly see your house and all your liabilities disappear in the same way as happens in Dickens novels and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And Adrian Woolridge, I guess we can't entirely skip past all of that recorded history. The experience that that governments had with these great chartered companies, and we mentioned the East India Company, but there were great disasters as well. The South Seas Company that was so terrible in Britain, and the Mississippi Company that was so disastrous for the economy of France just before that. But also that Americans sometimes don't remember the role that these chartered companies played in the development in the establishment of this country.
Absolutely, America wouldn't be here if it wasn't for these chartered companies. Companies like the Plymouth Bay Company or the Virginia Company were actually the organizations which founded America. People came over here as part of corporations in order to make a certain amount of money, and they were given a license to do that by Elizabeth I or James I.
You actually find, just to add one thing, you actually find James I complaining desperately about the idea of companies and being very annoyed about these seditious organizations. And that, in fact, has been a theme pretty much throughout the history of the company.
Well, another
on
big,
the one hand, they can be organizations of the state, but they can also be rather seditious.
Well, another big complainer was Adam Smith, considered the father of capitalism.
Absolutely. Adam Smith regarded companies as extremely inefficient, dangerous things. They were too monopolistic, they were too cumbersome, they were too bureaucratic, and they didn't do the same thing that an entrepreneur would do, which is to bear immediate responsibility for risk. So he was a great critic of the corporation, paradoxically.
And you describe this as the agency problem. I guess you probably aren't the first people to describe it that way, but the idea that what is a manager, a company man, how can he possibly manage a company with the same kind of passion and interest that somebody who actually owns it.
That's what Adam Smith thought, that managers just simply weren't very efficient because they didn't really have their own futures, their own money at stake in the company. So he wanted entrepreneurs to be in charge. He wanted to have a world of very small companies and of partnerships.
You can see that in a sense in Enron. I mean, a lot of people look at Enron and think what those people had at stake. People did not have the same. The managers of Enron perhaps had a different agenda to the shareholders. And that problem has run all the way through capitalism, all the way from the South Sea Company, all the way through to Enron. And it will continue. It's very difficult to find a way around it. But despite all those things, companies are the best form of wealth-producing machine we've managed to come up with.
Adrian Woolridge, you say that in the book that though this was a Victorian invention in England, it first came to perfection in this country, largely to deal with the problem of the railroad.
Absolutely. The railroads were really the first of all, they were the first giant companies, the first huge bureaucratic companies with the railroads which spread. But just because of the logic of scale here, they have to be huge. But also the railroad is not just the prototypical company, but it brings in other companies in its wake. It creates other opportunities for other companies because it creates a national marketplace. So it's only after you've had the railroad that you get gigantic steel companies, gigantic car companies, gigantic retail companies like Sears Roebuck.
So marketing, national marketing, branding, all of this becomes possible with the railroad.
Absolutely. It was really an extraordinarily powerful institution, the railroad company. I think, more powerful probably than Microsoft is today.
I think it's interesting if you go back and you look at John Jacob Astor, he ran his entire business with just about sort of five or six people in a small hotel in New York. By contrast, once you get to things like Sears Roebuck, or just to use the example Adrian mentioned, suddenly you have to have a huge marketing organization that goes all the way across the country. You've got to have suppliers, distributors, and that required a different sort of organization than one had ever existed before.
Now, you come to a remarkable argument in your book. Nowadays, you write, the influence of this unsettling organization is pervasive. Hegel predicted that the basic unit of modern society would be the state. Marx, that it would be the commune. Lenin and Hitler, that it would be the political party. Before that, a succession of saints and sages claimed the same for the parish church, the feudal manor, and the monarchy. The big contention of this small book, your book, The Company, A Short History of a Revolutionary Idea, is that they have all been proved wrong. The most important organization in the world is the company, the basis of the prosperity of the West and the best hope for the future of the rest of the world. Well, why don't we take those one at a time? Basis of the prosperity of the West, John Micklethwaite?
I think you can make that argument. I think it's a powerful reason why the West outstripped other forms of, if you go back to the Muslim world, if you go back to China before, one of their basic reasons whilst they failed to compete was their inability to produce companies. A big problem in the Muslim world was a rather quaint or difficult bit of legal law, which meant that when people died, their partner could only be had to give away all his shares to all his family rather than just nominate somebody. And this made it very, very difficult for companies to grow in any shape. And so the same kind of pressure that happened in the West to create proper companies never really came about. And in China, you had a different set of problems involving the emperor intervening a great deal. But the basic point is that companies have proved the best way in which to distribute capital. It's not just a question of being more productive. It's also a question of being a rather weird, strange being. Here's this thing which can never die, which can change shape very, very rapidly, and which can mutate into different ideas. You can set up a company to do one thing, and yet it ends up doing something completely different. Look at Minnesota Mining and Minerals. Now it makes Post-it notes, and yet nobody is gained largely from doing that.
After Enron, Adrian Woolridge, the best hope of the future?
Not all companies are perfect, and Enron is certainly an example of a company that wasn't perfect. But I think the point about companies really being instruments of incredible improvement in productivity is a very powerful point. I mean, one example would be Japan. If you look at what happened in Japan from the 1870s onwards, it was a country that suddenly discovered this Western idea of companies. The ruling elite then bought in companies, and these companies became really the agents of Japan's extraordinary prosperity, particularly after the Second World War. So not all companies are perfect. Certainly Enron has been a disaster. But the interesting thing about Enron is it failed. We've got rid of it. The energy industry survives, but this rather fraudulent and certainly badly conceived company has been got rid of. The companies also limit the size of disasters. In a world without companies, in the world of the planned economy of the Soviet Union, there was no check on failure. Failure was sort of embedded into the system, and it was brushed under the carpet. With companies, in the end, they can collapse, they can be got rid of, and although there is a lot of damage, the damage isn't pervasive and systemic in the whole society.
We're talking about the new book, The Company, A Short History of a Revolutionary Idea, with its authors John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge of The Economist magazine. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Let's begin with Tara, who's on the line with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, Neil and Adrian. This is Tara.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment that I work for a big corporation. I work for Wells Fargo, but I'm much more cooperative-minded in my philosophy. I belong to a food co-op, and I also think that a better model is a model where corporations give their profits much more back to their employees, and it's not so centralized in the upper echelons of the executives. I'm also very much into the open source software model versus big company like Microsoft. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, and just wondering if you could comment on that.
Absolutely. I very much sympathize with you. I do think the future is going in your direction, not in the other direction. I think the average size of companies, it may not feel like this to many people, but the average size of companies has actually been going down since the 1970s. Go back to the end of the 19th century, and it was really American economy in particular was dominated by a handful in many ways of absolutely giant trusts. A company like Ford Motor Company is a huge, huge operation employing thousands and thousands of people. In the 1960s and 1970s, again, you have an American economy which is dominated by a relatively small number of companies, the car business, for example, by three huge companies. Markets are fragmenting. Companies, on average, are getting smaller for many reasons, not least global competition and technological innovation, which makes it easier to start up companies and the fact that it's easier to get access to capital. But also, I think, internally, even big companies are trying to act as though they're small companies. They're breaking themselves down into smaller parts because they want to get the enthusiasm of people. People feel very much as you feel, that they want to feel part of something, they want to be in control of their own lives. So I think the idea that the future belongs to big companies is wrong. And I also think those American companies that think that they've got a great future in awarding their executives gigantic pay rises also, I think, will be proved to be wrong in the longer term.
Tara, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about what may be the most influential leftover from the Victorian era, The Company. When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. Tell us your company tales. The address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. On Talk of the Nation, we're talking about how the modern day company shapes our lives and how our lives shaped it. Adrian Wooldridge is with us here in Studio 3A. His co-author John Micklethwaite is at BBC's Broadcasting House in London. Their new book is called The Company, A Short History of a Revolutionary Idea. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. How have companies shaped your life? Do you work for one, or perhaps you run one? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go right to the phones. Our next caller is Ron, who's in Portland, Oregon.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that people are less and less invested, at least in this country, in the vision or the value that is supposed to be being produced by their companies. It was just commented on before the break with respect to feeling connected, feeling like their interests, their aspirations, their goals are intrinsic to the goals of the company, and that they're really producing value that they want to get up every day and work, you know, 40 plus hours a week to produce. With just leaving that comment out there as a prelude to my question is whether you would have a comment with respect to the connection between business and education, or the erosion of educational preparation, so to speak, for business service, given that more and more people seem to feel like the corporations are controlling them rather than vice versa, and that many people tend, I think, to be bucking the system. The trend is for people to say, I don't want to go to work for corporate America. I'd rather go out and pioneer and try to do something different and be happy with my life. So hope that's clear.
Okay. Well, Ron, one of the things they do write about is a sort of an anti-business educational approach, particularly in Britain, but I think to some degree in this country as well, where the culture of a lot of particularly elite institutions is that business is grubby.
Right.
Okay. John Micklethwaite?
Well, I think you're onto a very good point. I mean, what's happening a little bit at the moment, I think, two things are slightly fighting against each other. On the one hand, you see a sort of diminution in the idea of companies as homes. Company man's gone. Company man was driven out of business by re-engineering and all those terrible 1990s fads and by takeovers and things like that.
Right.
And people no longer think of companies as a place you can go there and stay there for a long time and get a nice gold watch at the end of it. That's certainly happening, and the idea that companies are sort of homes is going. On the other hand, I think you could argue that companies are probably in many ways doing more good than they did before. I mean, in some ways the contract is becoming simpler, that if you look at the idea that companies are getting more sort of evil nowadays, it's very difficult to say that and then look back at the Royal Africa Company branding people with its initials as slaves. I think that there's two bits going on, but I don't think in terms of education, I think the biggest problem is the idea that people don't really know enough about companies, particularly looking back, and we were, to be honest, somewhat scandalized by the level of knowledge or indeed just general information about which was out there about where companies had come from, what they were doing, what their aims were, how they had changed and so on. So I think there is room for business education. Obviously I have a vested interest in pushing the idea of histories of the company, but I think there is actually a vast area of history that people have neglected.
Adrian?
I think also in terms of people's attitude to companies, I think there is a strange discontinuity in here. On the one hand, people might think that companies in general are rather bad, and they read about Enron and WorldCom, and they think that these are scandalous organizations driven by greedy people to malevolent ends. But the impression I get in the United States is people actually like the companies that they work for. They regard them as a sort of, to some extent, a home from home. They think that they're generally doing good things in the world, and they devote an extraordinary amount of their time and passion working for those companies. And if they don't like that, what they often do is set up a company of their own. As entrepreneurs, they'll go out and try and create a new company, a new organization. So I think in general, companies have taken a hit from Enron, but against that, there is, in America at least, a huge residual faith in this organization.
Ron,
I can add just one thing quickly on that, is that the time thing is incredibly important. If you think of the amount of time even lazy journalists like Adrian and I spend writing for working for our company, or indeed maybe even broadcasters, there are people who go out there and they spend a huge amount of their time with companies, and it's, I think, a source of enormous and very obvious friction with the other great social organization of our times, which is the family.
Ron, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Julie Parker. Microsoft is an interesting example of a multinational corporation because I've seen it go from two guys with an idea to a huge billion-dollar concern. I'm curious what my seven-month-old daughter will be learning in history class about Microsoft and its effect on American and world history. Adrian,
I think that's a fascinating point. I think if you look at the East India Company, it was an organization which lasted for almost 300 years. I wonder if Microsoft's going to last for 300 years. I think the life cycle of companies is getting much, much shorter. I think we live in a world in which it's much easier than ever before to start a company, and you can be in the most obscure parts of the world and still become a global player. Look at Nokia, which started off as a Finnish company which used to manufacture lavatory paper and Wellington boots, decided to go into the mobile telephone business, and now, you know, one of the world's biggest companies, if not the biggest company in that market. So on the one hand, companies can spring up from the most obscure parts of the world and become giant multinationals. On the other hand, I think the idea of a company now lasting for 250 years is much more difficult than it used to be.
Let's go to Marcio, who's with us from Boston.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I heard you talk about companies and railroads, and it reminds me of a great book I just finished reading, The Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. Has your guest been inspired at all by this book? And I'll take my answer off there.
Okay. I just wanted to let you know, Marcio, many years ago as a young broadcaster, I met the author and was curious as to how she pronounced her name. And she told me it was Ayn as in Schwein. So
Ayn.
Oh. Ayn Rand. John Micklethwaite?
Great.
I'm going to ruin your expectations by saying I haven't actually read Atlas Shrugged, but I think actually Adrian has.
Adrian?
I've read bits of it. I'm afraid as literature I wouldn't judge it as in the top division of books. I mean, she was a great believer in the entrepreneur, the vigorous entrepreneur. I'm not really, I think, a supporter of companies or company man, more an anarchist than an organization person.
Let's go now to George, who's on the line from Glendale, Arizona.
Yes, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I don't have such a rosy view of corporations as it seems by your authors, mainly because as a physician, I see corporations undermining the fundamental individuality of people. Even our political parties are corporations. People are not seen as entities unto themselves. They're seen as parts of a company, as an overall thing. You now have to get your insurance through your corporation or through some big conglomerate. You can't be seen as an individual going to make the marketplace compete for your individual business. I see it as a potential total devastation or a wrecking ball for modern democracy.
John Micklethwaite, do you want to handle that?
Well, the answer is yes. There are definite examples of companies being allowed into politics in a way that they shouldn't be allowed, usually, and far more sort of dramatically outside America than inside America. I think, however, basically the problem to do with companies, there's a big problem which society faces at the moment, is that politicians tend to like outsourcing, to use that awful word, ideas and things to companies. They like the idea of companies being able to distribute the pensions, doing the health insurance, because it gets it off the state's back. And they also like the idea of imposing requirements on the company about things like equality, about ideas about trying to get rid of racism, about ideas about trying to make society a more equal place. Fundamentally, I think the company is a fantastic wealth-creating machine, but that's really its main purpose. It's not necessarily that good at some of the social things that society at the moment wants to place on it. It's not often as bad as people think, but the decision, say, to use health insurance via companies, I suppose the obvious rejoinder to that is, would you really want it to be done through the state? Would that be any better?
Not the state.
Sorry?
Do it through the individuals and not the state. People can have babies, they can buy houses, they can go to college, but they can't be trusted with the most intensely personal decisions of their lives. Who will have control over their health care of themselves and their families? This is an outrage.
But is that necessarily the corporation's fault, or isn't that the government's fault?
Both.
Surely there needs to be a better legal structure.
Well, it's
certainly
both.
We've always supported the idea of giving more to the individual.
the corporations and the governments have overreached themselves, and it's even gotten to the point where you have Ted Turner giving money to the United Nations. You have the head of Microsoft giving money to these various countries. Although these are laudable, the things they're trying to do, but who's to say that around the back door they're not saying, "Look, give me this little break over here," as the head of Microsoft did with Bill Clinton, and now it's trying to get computers in every classroom. Everyone has to have a computer. Most people don't need computers. They stop using their brains. They're using the computers all the time.
You raised the question in this way in your book, Adrian Woolridge. Is the company essentially a private association subject to the laws of the state but with no greater obligation than making money, or a public one which is supposed to act in the public interest?
A hard question to answer. I would say to the questioner that you could go back over the last 100, 200, 300 years and find people making exactly the same argument as you're making, that the company is this terrible, anonymous, soulless entity that's ruling the world in a rather Machiavellian, unpleasant way. Now, I think there's some truth in that, but there's less truth now than there has been in the past. If you go back to 1900, you have really a handful of gigantic companies running the United States, running much of the world. And you have people like J.P. Morgan and John Rockefeller with an extraordinary amount of power. And I think the history of the last 100 years has been one of the power of the corporation, of individual corporations, actually declining. Companies are getting smaller. The amount of choice that individuals have over their lives is actually getting greater because of the competition between companies. So the power of the individual is growing. Now, I regard the health insurance system in this country as extremely frustrating. Anybody who deals with it knows its extraordinary limitations. But nevertheless, you know, the world is a better place now than it was in 1900, and individuals have more power vis-a-vis corporations than they did then.
Here's an email question. Dear TOTN, writes Philip in Hollywood, Florida, could the U.S. government be considered a company? It sells bonds, stock in itself. It attempts to create an environment for other companies to prosper, which in turn, via taxes, creates wealth for itself. If so, is not the U.S. government the largest company on earth?
Can I take that? That actually brings up to me a really interesting point, is that particularly people on one side of the globalization debate in particular endlessly come up with this idea that companies are as big as states. Well, and firstly, statistically, that's usually wrong. They usually cite a statistic saying that 50 out of 100 biggest economies in the world are actually companies. In fact, if you use the proper figures, it's closer to about 30.
Oh, but only 30?
Point, well, yes, only 30, and also only two of them, I think, come in the top 50, which I think was Walmart and Exxon, I think.
That's right.
The main point is, even if you look at Walmart, Walmart's a very good example. If you look at Walmart and compare its value added to that of a state, then in the end, you end up with a state somewhere along the lines like Peru. Yes, Walmart may seem at first sight to be as big as Peru, but actually you look at what Walmart can do even against that very dysfunctional state of Peru. The answer is remarkably little. Peru can tell you, it can force you to go to prison, it can force you to go in the army. It rules a great number. The government of Peru still has a vast amount of power. Walmart may be a wonderful or terrible store, but the reason why it's done well is purely really because it's quite good at retailing. That's pretty much what it does. I think when you look at governments and you look at companies, it's actually the harder you look at it, the more you begin to see that most of the powers, most of the real powers in terms of military power, in terms of political power, lie with the government, not with the company still today.
We're speaking with John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge about their new book, The Company, A Short History of a Revolutionary Idea, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's go to Roland, who's on the line with us from Los Angeles.
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. The author said that in the 1870s, Japan had taken over the concept of the company and used it to their benefit, and yet the tragedy that befell Japan in the late 30s and the early 40s, I guess it didn't seem to help them very much in that era. And I was just wondering why that was.
I think that's a very good point. I think Japan, certainly, the Japanese ruling elite in the 1870s, 1880s, decided that it must modernize. And one of the things it must borrow from the West is the idea of the corporation, but it borrowed it in a way which rendered the corporation subservient to the desires and intentions of the government. They set up large companies which were connected very closely with certain parts of the government and which were woven into government policy. Exactly, incidentally, the same sort of pattern happens in Germany. So I think when you then get a government that's militaristic, that's bent on imperial expansion, the company then, although it's an extraordinary tool of prosperity, is also becomes in the hands of the government an extraordinary tool of imperial expansion, rather like the East India Company was for Britain. And it's really after the Second World War in 1945, when the companies are really freed to some extent from government control, that that the prosperity really takes off in a way that's undistorted by militarism and imperialism. So you're half right. It's certainly the case that Japan became a more prosperous country because it adopted the corporate form, but it's certainly not the case that it became a liberal country because it didn't.
Thanks very much, Roland.
Thank you.
I wanted to raise five. We just have a couple of minutes. I wanted to raise two emails which seem to be connected. Ron Williams writes, as a once avid free trade laissez-faire proponent shocked by the corporate scandals of the last decade, I am now more in favor of fair trade and reasonable constraints on business. What are your guest thoughts on that? And also from GP Whitdeveen in St. John's, Michigan, he writes, Dear, the Ben and Jerry's model, in which the top pay is 10 times that of the entry-level pay, what are the precedents for this voluntary restraint on executive salaries, and what are the prospects of seeing more of this kind of restraint and solidarity of labor and management? John, why don't you go first?
I think on fair trade, I mean, the big problem with fair trade is it sounds very attractive, but the difficulty is setting those quote-unquote reasonable constraints. Now, if you look throughout the history of the company, the society generally has always been placing constraints on companies, many of them completely correctly. You see people bringing in laws about unions, forcing American companies to talk to unions, to deal with them. You see laws about working practices. On the whole, it's very difficult to come up with laws about trade that don't become vehicles for protectionists to hide behind. I mean, for instance, just to give you a very quick example, if you look at textiles, most of the main opponents of cheap third world textiles coming into America tend to be American textile makers trying to keep them out. And you could argue that causes untold suffering and poverty in many parts of Asia in particular. But it isn't, it's just a very, very difficult thing to do. So my general response, without getting into all the particulars, is to be slightly suspicious of forced fair trade things, but to be very enthusiastic for ideas of voluntary covenants where people put labels on your coffee saying this is fair trade coffee or whatever. That seems to work reasonably well. I'll leave Ben and Jerry and executive pay to Adrian.
Well, we'll have to leave them making their paltry executive salaries because we're afraid we're out of time. But thanks to you both. That was John Micklethwaite was with us from BBC's Broadcasting House in London. Adrian Woolridge was here in Studio 3A. In addition to their new book, The Company, they both work for The Economist magazine. When we come back, the new unemployment figures. What's behind that? I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.